Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, why the press can't get it right when it comes to covering Donald Trump. The death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg last week is, of course, a major news story, and the political fight ahead to replace her will crowd out many other important issues as we approach Election Day. James Fallows sees this coverage as emblematic of just how the media continues to fall into the same traps they did back in 2016. From the emphasis on both-sidism to getting wrapped up in the horse race, important stories can get buried, especially when it comes to the breaking of democratic norms. I spoke with James Fallows, staff writer at The Atlantic, this morning. Jim, you recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic titled, "The Media Learned Nothing from 2016. How do you think that title or that thought applies to the current situation in regard to, sadly, the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and now the scramble to put her replacement on the court as quickly as possible? Talk about how the media is dealing with that.
I've been thinking about that exact question a lot in the last week or so. My piece came out in The Atlantic 1 week ago, and of course, Justice Ginsburg's sad death was several days ago. And I think that many of the patterns, many though not all of the patterns we're seeing in press coverage now resemble what I was warning against. And I'll mention two of them. The most powerful is something I'm sure you very, very well understand, Diane, from the people you've interviewed over the decades and the media you've worked in, which is how much more comfortable most people in the reporting world are if they can put themselves in what they imagine is between the two sides' positions. They can say, well, one party is saying this and one party is saying that. You, the listeners, you, the readers, will have to decide. And that makes it really difficult when you have, for example, the subject I was writing about in the piece, a president who just is unconstrained by the truth and just, you know, is making things up or lying constantly. Or in this present case, with the next Supreme Court opening, where you have one entire political party doing exactly the opposite of what every one of its members committed to do 4 years ago with great solemnity and great principled stance that it was the wrong thing when President Obama was nominating Merrick Garland for a seat on the court. It would be the wrong thing to have that vote before the people had spoken months and months ahead. It was, I guess, 9 months before the election that Obama made that nomination. Now, those same people, led by, of course, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, and his Republican, almost all of his Republicans in the Senate, are saying, well, of course, we need to get this through in the next couple of weeks. And it is difficult for most reporters to render this as something that's a real historical discontinuity. I was reading stories, I won't for the moment name them, but I can later on in a couple of leading political journals about how the tactics were being, the battlefield was being drawn up, and McConnell had these arguments on his side, and the Democrats had these arguments, as opposed to telling people, this is just different. This is entirely black and white. How Lindsey Graham, for example, would handle the fact that he was making a very passionate mark me down for history claim 4 years ago that there should never be a vote during an election year. So the sort of both sides-ism is one part of it. The other is just kind of the attraction towards political horse race-ism of just viewing this all as a matter of tactics rather than the underlying substance. So I fear that I'll be doing a sequel to this in the next couple of days about how it's not only the lessons of 2016, but the lessons of last week that it will be good for our colleagues to learn.
And as you and I are speaking, we've just learned that Mitt Romney and Cory Gardner will agree to go forward with a nomination from the White House as opposed to siding with Democrats who believe it should wait until after the election.
Yes. And what is so fascinating about that pairing of Republican senators, Cory Gardner, of course, from Colorado, up for re-election now, Mitt Romney from Utah, I believe he was elected 2 years ago or whatever, he has he's not up for election for a while, is they illustrate otherwise opposite types of Republicans who are sort of coming to the same, who for different versions of a similar pressure are coming to the same outcome. Here's what I mean. Cory Gardner has, even before this, been seen as in trouble in his reelection race in Colorado against former governor, former mayor John Hickenlooper, who has been running by most polls ahead of him. Colorado is not a rock-solid Republican or Trumpite state. Trump has been unpopular there. You would think that it would be in Cory Gardner's advantage in a time like this, if he has, you know, just a couple of weeks before the election to say, well, I like you people in Colorado, I'm an independent person, like Susan Collins in Maine, sort of in the same situation, or Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, that I am my own person, I'm going to represent you. But his early decision was there was more to fear by turning against Trump than there was by playing to the middle, which in other election years, you would have thought there was more to be gained by playing to the middle. Mitt Romney, of course, is the opposite extreme. Mitt Romney has essentially nothing to fear for the rest of his political life. He is personally very prosperous. He's a former political candidate. He has been respected. He was the lone impeachment vote from the Republicans against Trump on one count of impeachment. He's not up for election for a long time. He has nothing to fear. And I've understood from talking with friends in the Senate that even Mitt Romney, with everything he has going for him, has been so sort of ostracized for his impeachment vote that even he, contrary to what you have to know are his principles, is going this way. So this is the power of the Republican bloc at this moment under Trump, that somebody who do better if he could stand up against Trump in theory is standing with him, and somebody who doesn't need to care about Trump and has stood against him, Mitt Romney, are both coming together this way against what both of them declared 4 years ago is the right thing to do.
And talk about someone who doesn't need to care. Think about Lamar Alexander.
Yes, and this is something when historians write about our time later on, hoping there are historians, hoping we survive this time, I think something they're going to really marvel at, and not in a good way, is the situation of somebody like Lamar Alexander now, or let's say Bob Corker 2 years ago, a Republican senator from Tennessee who had decided not to run for reelection, or even Jeff Flake from Arizona 2 years ago, where these are people where for different reasons decided they were leaving the Senate. Jeff Flake, it's because he had sort of lost popularity in Arizona because of being independent. Lamar Alexander is, I believe, 80 years old or so. He's had a very distinguished career as a governor, as a cabinet secretary, president of the University of Tennessee. He has nothing to aspire for in terms of his reputation. You would think that he too would say, why do I need Trump's approval? Why do I fear tweets from Trump? And be the person the historians would look to as the Margaret Chase Smith kind of counterexample. She, of course, being the first Republican senator from Maine to turn against Joe McCarthy back in the 50s, or William Fulbright turning against Lyndon Johnson on the Vietnam War. I don't understand the calculus why people who have a long lifetime of achievement and principle behind them and have the esteem of their family and their peers and historians mainly to aim for, why they are not standing up for what I assert they must know to be the right thing to do.
So, Jim, considering the names we just talked about, how do you think the press is handling it now? And how do you think they should be handling this now?
So as you and I speak, we're only 2+ days, maybe 3 days into the aftermath of Justice Ginsburg's death. And it was remarkable that it was, I believe, only 1 hour after that. It might have been 2 hours, between 60 and 120 minutes after news of her death was reported that Mitch McConnell was announcing the Senate is going to vote and that Trump was beginning his tweets. I got yesterday, that is to say less than 48 hours after her death, about 100 fundraising emails from the Trump campaign, whose list I'm on, saying, you know, fill her seat, et cetera. So it's we're still early in this coverage, but I think that already much of the press has switched to a normalizing, you know, this is another political battle kind of front. And here's an example of what I mean. There was a, this was in the prominent political newsletter Axios. They had a their morning letter on Monday of the week after Justice Ginsburg's death. The lead article was something like, Democrats prepare for all-out war. And what they meant by all-out war was saying, I think Senator Schumer, the minority leader, and some others saying that if the Republicans push ahead with something that is such a violation of norms, including the ones they established 4 years ago, then the Democrats may be forced to do things as well, which is including increasing the size of the court. This was, and I think that what struck me about it is that all-out war implies you have no attention to pre-existing rules. What the Democrats are proposing is if the Republicans will push the rules to the hilt because they can, then we too, if we are back in power, we will also view previous norms as not limiting us. That was not a threat. It was just saying this is how things go. So can I just add one background that I think is important here? Long ago in college, I studied, you know, American history and government, and people who've studied comparative government around the world recognize there are problems when democratic systems become unrepresentative. And the U.S. has some unrepresentation built into it by the nature of the Senate, you know, where Wyoming has the same number of seats as California, though California has 70 times more people, et cetera. That's part of our founding compromise. But things have become more skewed recently. And if it is the case, both that Donald Trump gets his nominee through in these next couple of weeks, and that Joe Biden wins the presidential election, it will have been the case that in seven of the last eight presidential elections, starting with 1992, the Democrats will have won the most votes. And that in all years except two in that period, or maybe either two or four, Democratic senators represented more of the population than Republican senators did. And the House was back and forth. So you have, in a small D Democratic system, you have a fairly strong Democratic Party presence, whereas the Supreme Court in that case would have six of its nine lifetime members be appointed by Republicans. And this is partly the cruel actuarial luck of the draw with how we appoint Supreme Court justices now, but it is unrepresentative. And if we viewed this in other countries, we'd think there's a kind of tension there, where most people are not being represented, not being heard. And so I think, anyhow, the press should portray this less as another battle over some funding bill for, you know, name your agency, and more of something about the structural tensions that our country is facing right now.
You know, I thought it was so interesting that Vice President Biden's comment was, this is pure, raw politics. Well, I wanted to say, duh. I mean that. I mean, yes, exactly. It's raw political gamesmanship. It's turning attention away from COVID, from the economy, from joblessness, from healthcare. It's focusing on this one extraordinarily important issue, which is the Supreme Court. But does the media make the same mistake by turning completely toward this fight?
Diane, yes, thank you for making a point I intended to make and making it much better than I was going to, which is that another thing I was mentioning, and that now ancient history 1 week ago article in The Atlantic is just the spectacle power that Donald Trump has had in continuing to create new crises that are just so consuming that cable news will run its blowout coverage of them, and they push everything off the front page. And a great big nomination fight is one of those things too. Of course it matters, but there was somebody, one of our leading papers again, last day or two, who said, expect showmanship from Donald Trump's unveiling of a new nominee, because he is a showman and he knows if he can get cable news to be riveted by this for a couple days, that's a few more days of the now 42 until the election, and many people already voting, which are not about pandemic, economic, structural collapse, China, North Korea, et cetera. So yes, it is a spectacle. Probably from the crassest political interest, Trump might well do better to wait until the lame duck to have this fight. Because then, you know, the same senators who are now in office, with the possible exception in one in Arizona with a special election, they'd still be a Republican majority. They could pass a nominee then. There would be less of the unseemly rush. But he likes to have a spectacle now, having a spectacle. So yes, I think being I often use the image of a cat chasing the dot on a laser pointer on a wall, sort of, you know, the cats are distracted by where the laser dot is. That is how many people in our business, that's our temptation with Trump, because he is the most powerful laser dot who can take you from one outrage to the next.
So if the press, the media in general, continues on this line following the dot, where does that leave the American people? Where does that leave us who are so in need of education about what is happening in not only this country, but this country's place in the world?
That is a sobering question, and let me speak short-term and then longer-term. Short-term, when it comes to this election, the surprising thing compared to other elections we've seen, one I worked in long ago with Jimmy Carter, the trends we've seen, it appears that the dynamics of news coverage have less effect on the apparent vote than in most of the years, because people seem to be allied into their tribes or their concepts. So the people know that what they think about Donald Trump, for better or worse. And there's a minority of people who are really all for him, and there's a statistical majority of people who are not for him, and maybe the coverage won't affect that at all. And what will matter is how the actual voting happens, of how whether the mails work and whether voter registration is altered, et cetera. In the longer term, of what happens after that, when somebody where either Trump again or Vice President Biden and a new Congress needs to try to do things, I think that the endless struggle of the press to try to keep itself in business by doing things that are interesting enough, attractive enough, will support enough commercial underwriting, balance between that and what we think people need to know about how things are happening in China, who actually pays for tariffs, what's happening with NATO and in Africa and all the rest. That balancing act has been made really difficult by the phenomenon of Donald Trump, who consumes all this attention and oxygen. The challenge for the next stage, whenever Trump goes away, is again overcoming the economic hurdles our whole business faces and the siloing of people that's been accelerated by social media. And that is a bigger topic than I think either of us can wrestle with at this moment. I think that whenever Trump is not there as a attractive, distracting force, we can sort of devote more time to the many other efforts that are there to try to see how can the press recapitalize itself to do the job it has to do.
More from James Fallows, staff writer for The Atlantic, when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with James Fallows, staff writer for The Atlantic. His new piece is titled, "The Media Learned Nothing," from 2016. So President Trump has said he will name his choice by perhaps this weekend after the memorial service, after the funeral for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Do you believe that the press will understand that it's got to continue to focus on these other issues that are so incredibly important once he's named that person and once the fight begins? Or is that going to take up all the oxygen?
I have the dreaded yes and yes answer, where yes, it is still the case that many parts of the press, many parts of the media are trying to do what there was this famous editor of the Manchester Guardian back in the 1850s who adapted a famous line from poetry to say that the role of the press is to see things steady and see them whole. That is to present a kind of continuous view of things. And I think if you'll find that our main newspapers, if you look at the entirety of their front section, they talk about the political battles, but also where the next pandemic is coming from and what kind of people are being laid off and what regional patterns we're seeing and climate disasters, et cetera, et cetera. I think that is the case. Radio, not talk radio, but serious radio, is also, I think, mainly trying to present the variety of the world, and podcasts like yours. The weak link here is, of course, cable TV. Cable TV, which doesn't have that large of an audience in sheer tonnage, you know, it's 3 to 5 million people in a country of 300 million, but has significant steering current effects. You know, people in other parts of the media watch it and politicians watch it, and it's kind of an alert. And I think cable news has a really hard time thinking of more than one thing at once. And so this may be pressure that we all can exert on cable news producers, that a Supreme Court battle matters. Also, the pandemic continues to matter. You know, we're now, have we passed World War I deaths? I believe that is the case. With 200,000, it's in the vicinity of World War I deaths. It's a historic disaster, not matched by any other developed country right now. The United States is unique in how poorly it has handled this, while the UK has struggled too. So I hope with all of our collective urging, we can encourage our colleagues to present the variety of the world, much of it challenging, but it's not all a confirmation fight.
So, in your view, does this nomination that Trump is going to make and the battle for the Supreme Court, does that help Donald Trump's campaign?
It is so hard to know. And I'm going to use this as a segue to a different point in a second, just because it's hard to tell whether, for example, if Donald Trump seems likely to appoint a nominee who may have been on the record saying that Roe v. Wade should be overturned, because there are some of these candidates who have said that. Would that prospect and perhaps a confirmation for a 6-3 court, would that motivate more women who were considering Trump to move away from him? I don't know. Will it motivate more evangelicals to really support him? I don't know. Would it motivate some evangelicals to think, well, we've already got this locked in? You know, that we don't need to worry about the justice anymore. I just don't know. Here is the thing I'll say as a segue. What I'd really like to see this kickoff for is long-term reform of the court. The American Academy of Arts and Sciences a few months ago put out a report echoing what lots of other people have said. The Supreme Court, as opposed to being these life tenure things, should be staggered 18-year terms. That is, every president would get a nomination every 2 years, and it wouldn't be this matter of just trying to see how long are people going to live, how young can you appoint them, and not the cruel fate of vacancies coming up in one time than not for another. So I think reform of the Supreme Court would be in everyone's interest in the long run.
And what about expansion of the court?
Yes, I think that this is something we're going to be hearing about after next year. We're going to be hearing about that because people, if they've heard about this issue, know about Franklin Roosevelt's famed court packing exercise back in the 1930s. They think, oh, well, this is established as a poor idea. As you, of course, know, Diane, the size of the court is not set by the Constitution and has changed many times in American history, although not in the past century or so. And the Democrats, I think, can make a case that the representation here has become so skewed. And the Republicans have now twice, with their stonewalling the Merrick Garland nomination and now with ramming through this new case, that they have not played by the rules everyone else thought prevailed. And so in that case, the Democrats can argue the court, for reasons of justice, needs to be expanded, which is within the rules. The same rules that are allowing Mitch McConnell to do what he's doing now would allow the Democrats to expand the court next year.
But hasn't Joe Biden already said he doesn't want to get into expansion of the court?
Number one, yes, he has said that. Number two, that's what you would expect from Joe Biden as an institutionalist of the Senate. He had been in the Senate for decades and decades. And number three, that is the wise thing for him to say now. This is not a fight that he needs right now. I think but it's something that I believe the Democrats in the Senate can say, if you're going to force us into this abnormal situation of rushing through somebody in a way you promised you wouldn't do 4 years ago, then you may force us to respond in similar terms. That if all of the sense of comity and decency and procedure that we thought prevailed before Merrick Garland and before this current rush, if you are not paying attention to those, if you're doing whatever you can do, then we will consider what we can do as well. And I think their goal will be to say, please don't rush this through. That would be their objection, that neither side had to sort of push to the max.
And Chuck Schumer has talked about the filibuster.
Yes. The filibuster, I think, is in the same category of something where previous norms were changed. As you know, back during, from say the 30s through the 60s or 70s, the filibuster was a rarely used tool, largely for Southern segregationists. Not exclusively, but Strom Thurmond, for example, was the most famous practitioner of the filibuster, senator from South Carolina during the civil rights legislation. And what it was when the Republicans went into the minority in the Senate under Barack Obama that suddenly use of the filibuster by Mitch McConnell skyrocketed, where you had most of the filibusters in American history were beginning to occur then. And so from a rarely used mechanism of sort of senatorial procedure, this has become the norm. And papers are saying, well, it takes 60 votes to pass a bill through the Senate. So I think the filibuster has been abused in a way that means the rules surrounding it should be reconsidered too.
Jim, we talked about members of the Senate whose seats are secure, but there are some races that are very much up for grabs. Susan Collins in Maine. How do you believe that her position in the Senate has been supported by Mitch McConnell, who could say to her, unless you go along with us on this, we will take any money coming your way away from you, so that threat for her contains the power of how she goes?
I'm one of those journalists who has never met Mitch McConnell, for better or worse, but I've read about him obsessively, and it seems as if what he finally cares about most even more than having a Republican president, is having a Republican Senate majority of which he can be the leader. So trying to protect his vulnerable ones, from Susan Collins to Cory Gardner to Lindsey Graham to the others you might name, to Martha McSally, for example, in Arizona, that is presumably of greater interest to him even than getting a nomination through or supporting Donald Trump. And in the crassest terms, it probably is good for Mitch McConnell's Senate majority if he can give Susan Collins a pass on this one, because he knows he can safely lose two or even three votes. The 53 seats for the Republicans in a tie, Mike Pence would vote to break the tie. So Mitch McConnell, this is kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card that he could issue to Susan Collins so she could be standing up for principle in the eyes of her independent mind Maine voters. I don't know that's what has happened. It would make sense in the hydraulics of things for that to happen. And it may be different for Cory Gardner in that I don't know why the situation for Cory Gardner is different from Susan Collins, but if she can say, I stand independent, that matters more in Maine as part of her reputation and the kind of the image of Maine that Mainers have of themselves. And McConnell could let her do that if that's what happened.
Right now, her numbers don't look great. Right now, it looks as though she quite likely could lose. So you're saying that if she can stand on her own, declare herself independent, that could be fine with her voters. And once she is reelected, if she is reelected, then she could be free in a lame duck session to vote to confirm whomever the president nominates.
Yes, she would be freer to do whatever she wanted. So speaking as a guy who is from California rather than from Maine, and with that limit and understanding Maine, my impression has always been that Mainers like the idea of independent, spirited people. And that's where Margaret Chase Smith was from. And they have actual independent, one of two independent senators, of course, Angus King, the other being Bernie Sanders. And so I think that from the if you were Susan Collins's campaign manager, I think you would be grateful for her getting a free pass from McConnell. And I imagine that she and McConnell have discussed that. But again, I don't know. This is just my hypothesizing from outside.
On the other hand, let's talk about Lindsey Graham. And as you referenced earlier in our discussion, his statements 4 years ago when Barack Obama wanted to nominate Merrick Garland and the Senate refused to even hear a word of it. And Lindsey Graham, right in line with Mitch McConnell, said, never in a presidential election year should someone be nominated and voted on for the Supreme Court. How best should the media play that issue?
I think it is, if you consider how relentless the media have been about some flip-flops in previous political eras, John Kerry being for the bill before it was against it, or whatever the sequence was, and Bill Clinton on various issues. This is a fundamental issue where Lindsey Graham said, as you recall, he said, you can bring this up 4 years from now. You bring it up and it ever comes up again. I'm never going to support confirming a justice during an election year. And he could not have been more all out and on the record. And he's come up with various hair's breadth distinctions now to say, well, things are different because there was the roughness of the Kavanaugh confirmation and there was a change in Senate command. But he couldn't have been, it couldn't be more of a fundamental flip-flop. And I think the press, the temptation will be to say, oh, well, we wrote about that last week. We don't need to keep ramming it home. But it's a fundamental issue that should every time his position on the current confirmation is raised, I believe that should be half of the sentence. Senator Graham, comma, who promised 4 years ago never to support confirmation during election year, comma, said blah, blah, blah.
You know, you have to wonder, looking at this whole presidential race, the way the media is handling it, and now with the complication, sadly, of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death and a nominee for the court. There's got to be a better way. What is that better way?
Number one, yes, there's got to be a better way. Number two, my long-term view, strengthened by living outside the country for many years, is that only a country with as many things fundamentally in its favor as America has, its scale, its geographical position, the diversity of its population, et cetera, only a country having as much going for it as we do could withstand a national governing system as antiquated as we have. And it's been largely good luck and respect for norms that sort of kept us away from the guardrails as time has gone on. And we've been close to the guardrails a number of times. We're getting close to the guardrails now. I think it is worth, again, a discussion of some of the fundamentals of our democratic mechanics. And I recommend once more this American Academy of Arts and Sciences report, which, and I'll send you all the link for this, which goes into a lot of things that could be changed without constitutional amendment, including increasing the size of the House of Representatives, which has been increased many times during our history, but not in the last century. And it's become, it would be healthier if it were larger. Interestingly, the one thing they say you'd have to amend the Constitution for is the results of the terrible Citizens United ruling in the last decade, led by Justice John Roberts, which essentially legalized all money into politics. That you would need to have a constitutional amendment to change. Most of the other things, from Supreme Court terms to size of the House to national holiday for voting, et cetera, that you could all do by legislation. So we need to pay attention to some of the, it's a machine that is getting old and needs some repair.
What do you think the best way forward for Democrats is on this Supreme Court fight?
I think they recognize that they cannot, in brute force, they cannot stop a nomination and confirmation if Trump, McConnell, et al. Are determined to push it through. You know, I am not a politician. If I were, I would think of trying as hard as possible to convince a total of four Republicans that this is wrong, that it will hurt them, it will hurt their personal reputations, and it's wrong for the country to ram this through before the election. That's the private track. The public track, I believe, is to continue arguing that this in public, that this is wrong, it will destroy the norms and limits. And if those norms and limits are destroyed, the way we will reasonably have to respond next year, or the next time we have the political ability to do it, is by expanding the court. So essentially, this is your choice, Republicans. If you want to go to all out doing everything that you have the muscle to do, all right, we can't stop you. But when we have the muscle, we will be obliged to use it in the same way. They should make clear that's not what they prefer to do. But if the Republicans force them to do that, then they should be ready for that is the next step. So I think try to argue that it'd be better for the country, for the party, and for everybody to do this in a more normal way rather than just ramming it in.
Do you think there's a chance that the media will get it right in these last 40-some days before the election, considering that you've got this Supreme Court battle as well as a presidential race going forward simultaneously?
We all live in hope, do we not? So I think that the media, as you know, are a huge, diverse, ever-changing, mercurial group that includes people. It's made of people like the two of us, and like everybody we know, who didn't go into this business as a way to maximize our income. We went into this business because we thought it's interesting and important, and we're happy if we can make a living while doing that. So I think if the more voices who are saying and who are demonstrating by broadcast, by stories, by videos, whatever, here are things to bring up, we can dynamically shift the center of gravity. So it's like a big scrum, where all members of the scrum, including you and me and others, are trying to push the scrum in the direction we think will be better.
Before we close, Jim, is there anything further you'd like to say to our listeners?
This is as important an election as I can imagine in my now quite lengthy career as a voter and as a journalist. And I am grateful to all of you for listening to this podcast and to Diane for producing it, because there is a stream of serious inquiry about our national condition, which this show represents. And so the more of us are thinking seriously about repairing the fabric of the country, the greater the chances of repair. So get out the vote.
Jim Fellows, great to talk with you again.
Diane, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverka of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you'll continue to wear those masks, keep a safe distance, and keep on listening. I'm Diane Rehn.